WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work offers a one-year advanced standing option for students with a bachelor's degree in social work that builds on prior training and connects students with expert faculty and 5 specialized pathways. Apply by February 1st at crownschool.uchicago.edu/socialwork. Inspire change. Shape the future.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. It's Friday, and that means it's time to look back at the week and make sense of the biggest local and statewide stories in our weekly news recap. Stories like these.
The Ventra app melting down on a day Metra is rolling out a new fare structure.
The app keeps failing.
A third weekday commute with Ventra app ticketing issues.
It's been a week since Lurie Children's Hospital's phone and internet services went offline.
Doctors are using pen and paper.
Protesters will be allowed to set up just outside the Democratic National Convention in Chicago this summer, despite opposition from Democratic officials.
That's due to a technicality. The city failed to respond to an application by the Poor People's Army within its own 10-day deadline.
This week, our panel includes Amanda Vinicky, correspondent for Chicago Tonight on WTTW, Alex Nitkin of the Better Government Association. He's a government finance and accountability reporter for the Illinois Answers Project, and Simone Alisea, executive producer of the CityCast Chicago podcast and newsletter. Amanda started with the ongoing situation at Lurie Children's Hospital. Its communications network has been shut down for over a week after it was accessed by a, quote, known criminal threat actor. Here's Amanda.
I don't know who that might be or what that might be other than that it is known. Hopefully not ever to me. It is scary to just think about on a personal level how your systems could get hacked, let alone when it is something like a children's hospital. So yeah. How cruel, first of all. I did speak with a cybersecurity expert who said, you know, Lurie is a well-funded hospital. This isn't a, you know, small operation that is unaware of what's at stake. He doesn't know the ins and outs of what protections they previously had in place, but sure, there were some. And I think that's where, you know, you have a lot of parents who have sort of the attitude, this could happen anywhere to anybody. Mm-hmm. And this proves and shows that.
What do we know so far about how it's affecting patients and how the staff are coping?
Well, so I will speak. Actually, my sweet little babe had to get shots today.
Aww.
So I came right from there, and it is not at the hospital, but, you know, a Lurie connected facility. And they're working off of papers. I mean, it is strange. I have another friend who unfortunately had to take her child to Lurie to the ER. Baby's fine.
Okay.
Had literally like a paper bracelet instead of one of the printed out plastic ones. Mm. I mean, they are literally dealing with paper. So there are signs that say things might be slow. Please be patient with us. And yet it continues. I think the question and the fear is, what sort of medical history could be revealed if, say, the expectation is that this is ransomware, if Lurie doesn't pay the ransom or this isn't resolved? It literally is that. Like, Lurie's is being held hostage is the presumption, and why typically you have these criminal actors doing that. And then is that going to harm patients because there is going to be a difficulty in accessing their medical histories? Will there be delays in surgeries and care that need to happen?
Mm-hmm.
Again, because all of this is offline. So cybersecurity experts say that likely, and this is not something we know from Lurie, that there is a backup to all of the information. It's just that when the systems are shut down, that you're not going to know it. So, for example, when I went to my appointment today, it was, what is she here for? Something that they would presumably know every other time because it's right up there on the appointment. It's scary.
Like, they legit did not know why she was there.
But I will add real quick, I'm sorry, just to move on, but that the people who I know who have really come into contact with the hospital itself mm-hmm. say that the staff has been incredible, that they're tired but are really thankful. This is, of course, a lot of high-stress situations. You go into a children's hospital, it can be incredibly heartbreaking
yes.
on a good day, and that they are working very hard to resolve this and yeah. just to take care of families.
I mean, Simone, I was going to ask you the same thing. I mean, I know black hat hackers aren't the good guys, but a children's hospital?
Right.
Come on.
Is that really where you want to go? I think, too, the other thing that's really even more stressful and frustrating about this particular attack, in addition to the fact, in addition to who the target was, is just the fact that it's gone on so long, right? This isn't a one-day outage, a two-day outage. We're going on 2 weeks now mm-hmm. Where, you know, patients and families are not able to access the stuff they're accessing, where we're not sure what the end result is going to be, kind of how it's going to get cleared up. And then, as Amanda said, you know, what may or may not be revealed or has been compromised in the process.
Yeah.
Just a really stressful situation all around.
CyberPros say that you're not supposed to give in to the ransom asks because even if you do pay, let's say the big bucks that they might be asking for,
yeah.
there's no telling that they'll be like, all right, you paid now, just wait, try again. Mm. I mean, it is such a difficult situation. Ooh,
yeah, yeah, I mean, Alex, we've seen small town governments or small businesses face, you know, ransomware attacks and, you know, a hacker locks employees out of systems. I can't remember a time I've seen a Chicago institution as big as Lurie's go through something like this.
I mean, it is really crippling and I think that people underestimate the amount of time that it takes to pick up the pieces from this kind of thing. Coincidentally, I was about to bring them up this office a little bit later when we talk about the primary, but the Cook County clerk of the circuit court, some folks might remember, I think it was maybe 2 years ago or so, they were hit by a big ransomware attack and they had to rebuild for months and months and redesign their website. And we're talking about all of the court records in the whole county. And so
the Illinois Attorney General's office.
That's right. Mm-hmm. They were too. I mean, the takeaway is that these institutions need to maybe get better at trying to learn cybersecurity or strengthen their infrastructure.
And it's interesting because you brought up how crippling it is in the now, but also long term. There are issues such as undermining, yes. I think, consumer confidence. And then there is also the question of litigation, what insurance is or is not going to pay. So actually, interestingly, Fitch just put something out that says, for now, the Lurie Children's Hospital credit rating isn't impacted, but this could be a huge long-term budget hit.
Did you get any sense of how much longer it might go on for?
We don't know. Yeah. It began the 31st, and Lurie initially didn't really say that what it was. We have since learned, as of just yesterday, actually, that this was a, quote, known criminal actor, and the FBI is on it.
Wow. All right, folks, from one yikes to another, Simone, Metro riders, they've been having a heck of a time in the last week, haven't they?
Yeah. So people might recall there was some talk about the changes to Metro's fare structure, right, going from 10 zones to 4 zones and the elimination of ticket windows. So as that was going into effect, the Venture app, where you're supposed to be able to buy tickets online, it just was not working. People could not access tickets. Mm-hmm. That was on the very first day last week. They thought it was fixed over the weekend, you know, Monday morning commute comes around, app shuts down again and it's not working.
I was trying to load fare for my kids mm-hmm. to get to school and not working.
Yeah. I mean, we looked it up on that morning too. And it was like trying to get from Hyde Park to Millennium Park. And it was like, no tickets available on a Monday morning during commute time. And I'm like, really? That seems unlikely. I don't think that's right. And I think it is, you know, this is not as, it sounds like the service has been restored and people have been able to, you know, for the most part, get into what they need to later this week. But I think it's just really frustrating, as I said, when you're trying to get to work or wherever it is you need to get to. You know, and also on top of it all, you might be dealing with the ticket price increase depending on like what route you're taking and how far you're going.
Because quite a few changes were made by Metro.
Exactly. Like I said, the switching of zones, there was also an elimination of a low fare discount that was enacted during the pandemic on the Metro Electric and Rock Island lines. I think it's just a frustrating start to this week, Sasha, all around.
Frustrating start to this recap. I mean, anyone else here a regular Metro rider?
once upon a time, not anymore. But I think that this comes as, of course, public transit systems are really in a hard way.
Especially
and you have
Metra.
Especially Metra, and you have folks, it's connected, of course, to a lot of work from home and the vacancy rates at offices downtown. And so this comes at a tough time. And as their hands are most certainly out for money from the state, as you have the regional transit systems collectively asking for an implementation of a sales tax on services, they want that money. So I don't think it's engendering any great will. I don't know that long term this is going to change that ask, but it is, I think, frustrating. Again, it undermines confidence in these systems at a time where they're trying to say, no, please remember us, take us.
Well, and the whole point of restructuring the fare system was to attract new riders after a pandemic dip in ridership, right? It was like, oh, we're simplifying this. You know, we're making it easier to buy tickets online. You don't have to, you know, it's not that sort of old-fashioned train ticket window thing.
It's kind of like, you know, technology. The more that we depend on it, the less you can depend on
absolutely.
It.
Oh, absolutely. And Simone, you at CityCast, you had put out a call to your listeners to hear some issues that folks were having. Anything else they shared?
You know, we haven't heard from any listeners specifically, but if you're listening to BEZ and you want to let us know, I mean, you can find our email on the website. but I do think it is something that Metra riders around the region have certainly spoken about and have been, like I said, been frustrated by. That's the word of the day is
frustration. All right. So in case folks haven't figured it out yet, the theme for this first part of our recap is glitches and snafus and frustration. Alex, why don't you tell us what's going on with the Poor People's Army and the Democratic National Convention?
Yeah, the Poor People's Army is one of many groups that, a protest advocacy group that has tried to get in line to hold demonstrations outside of the DNC, which I think is, you know, common and natural and to be expected. I think, if anything, what is a little bit surprising to me, at least, is that the city of Chicago is really making efforts to try and prevent those kinds of protests. And there has been some, I think, kind of breathless reporting about how this Poor People's Army somehow managed to get a permit to protest. And isn't this going to be embarrassing because the eyes of the world are on Chicago? And I'm kind of like, I don't know, how is there not going to be protests? This is like the most visible political event in the country. And this is Chicago, where like open air protests are like visible, or like breathable air in this city. They're like part of the architecture of the city. And I think that people have been talking about like, oh, does this mean it's going to be like the chaos of the 1968 convention when there were, you know, protests and riots and North Vietnamese flags in Grant Park? I would just remind people that a huge part of, I think, the shame around Chicago from the 1968 convention is not necessarily the breadth of the, like, First Amendment activity, but the really brutal repressive efforts that the city took to try and quell that, when the mayor of Chicago literally gave a public order to the Chicago police to shoot rioters. Mm. I think that in that context, it frankly to me is a little bit silly to be talking about trying to, like, prevent, especially, you know, a group like this. We're talking about probably a couple dozen, maybe a couple hundred people chanting outside of the United Center with like millions of people around. I don't see
things have been worse.
You know, I'm gonna say that as somebody who's been to these conventions, to me the question is going to be, how close are they going to get whether the city permits them or not, and what are the feds going to say about that?
Sure.
I think your point is very well taken in terms of the rights of free speech and the shame of Chicago in terms of repressing that and what came of it in 68. And there's certainly a recognition, I think, by both city officials and DNC organizers. Still, in order to get anywhere near the convention, you have to go through metal detectors. I mean, there is a process. There is a perimeter and a perimeter and a perimeter to get even close.
Wow.
And so I think as we get nearer that point, yes, there will be these local permits, but there's a whole other layer that we're just not at. There will be some sort of arena for protesters, I am sure, because Democrats in particular would get a lot of flack if
that would be
that
double-edged sword of like, oh, aren't you the party of
free
speech
and progressive
happen.
Ideas? I just think it's going to be, as we get closer, a question of where. That's where it's sort of the egg on the face of Chicago and missing a deadline.
And to your point, I mean, we've got tens of thousands of people who are going to be in town for this convention. This is August 19th to the 22nd. otherwise known as my birthday weekend. But not important.
That's why it's going to be so busy.
They're coming to celebrate me. No, they're not. But I'm wondering, though, as a resident, how disruptive y'all think this is going to be for everyday Chicagoans. I mean, anyone a little worried? Simone, what are you thinking?
I mean, it can't not be. It's thousands of people. It's a big event. But, like, you know, so was NASCAR. NASCAR was also really disruptive, and we made it through that.
We did.
I mean, like, Chicago is no stranger to hosting massive events. Lollapalooza attracts how many thousands of people every year downtown? And so, yes, it will be frustrating. There will be traffic. It will be disruptive. Probably there will be protests, and there will be many, many headlines, and it will, like, be visible for people, I think, throughout that time and as we get into the summer. But I think, you know, we got to take a step back and say that's always true in the summer in Chicago on some level.
If we can handle all those suburban teenagers, we can handle whatever the Democratic Party
I think so.
Now we turn to politics. Primary day in Illinois is now less than 40 days away. Now, if you're voting in person, polls will open at 6 a.m. on March 19th, but early and mail-in voting start much earlier. Here's Amanda with more on the major races.
I'll start with issues. I think that's a huge one, and that is going to be the, quote, bring Chicago home, the mansion tax, whatever you want to call it. And this is an effort by the Johnson administration and advocates for doing something about homelessness to bring more money and attention to that cause by raising the tax on high-priced real estate transfer tax transactions. So that's basically when you sell a building, there's a tax on that. And this would be something that the business community is really pushing up against, because they say that that will harm small businesses, any sort of big buildings, where, as I previously mentioned, the vacancy rates. And so you were going to expect a high dollar campaign. I don't think that you're going to have, per se, homeowners who have $1 million homes being part of that campaign. But then on the other side, of course, you're going to have the homeless advocates who have been advocating for something to be done and more money for that cause for quite some time. Mm-hmm. So that's really a huge one. There are no real statewide races. There are some of the things that I'm keeping my eye on include the Cook County State's Attorney's race, because that's one that's likely to be settled in the primary. Also, there is an area here in the city where there is a Supreme Court seat that is up for grabs on the state's high court. And you're really seeing that as something that has turned into, yes, experience, but also whether there will be the first Latino elected to the Illinois Supreme Court and what that means for the current Black justice who holds the seat now. Competitive congressional races, including whether Danny Davis will hold on to his seat. And then downstate, you have one where it's conservative versus conservative, but just, you know, sort of how conservative. And that would be the GOP former nominee for governor, Darren Bailey, trying to take a seat from incumbent Mike Bost, who himself has secured some endorsements that are pretty, again, conservative leaning and has more money.
Alex, you say the race for Cook County Clerk of the Circuit Court is flying under the radar. So why don't you take a moment and tell us about the role and why you think folks should pay attention?
That's right. Not to be confused with the Cook County Clerk, because, of course, this has to be confusing. The Cook County Clerk of the Circuit Court is responsible for a multi-hundred-million-dollar agency with hundreds of employees whose responsibility is overseeing all of the labyrinthine court records. Anytime you file a lawsuit staff a courtroom in Cook County, anywhere, it is all being overseen by the clerk of the circuit court. This is an office that was run by a person named Dorothy Brown for 20 years from 2000 to 2020, who was really bogged down with all kinds of accusations of corruption and mismanagement and patronage and just so many things going wrong, and really, I think, tanked the reputation of the court system. And for the last 3 years now, the clerk of the circuit court has been Iris Martinez, who has been really trying to turn things around, has a couple of accomplishments under her belt, most notably, I think, getting the Shackman patronage Federal Monitor off of the backs of the clerk of the circuit court. Mm-hmm. But they really are facing a lot of pressure from activists, from outsiders, folks like the Appleseed Center for Fair Courts have really been on our case and sort of talking about how things have been kind of slow. One issue that we, especially at the BGA, are following really closely is, you know, she campaigned on changing the state law so that court records in Cook County would be subject to FOIA, so that journalists like us could FOIA for public court records, which seems like a no-brainer. She had campaigned on that, but then Iris Martinez kind of turned around and settled for what she called a compromise, which was a really watered-down, basically ineffective version of that. And so she has a challenger named Marianna Spiropoulos, who's been endorsed by the Cook County Democratic Party and a lot of sort of movers and shakers. She's been a member of the Metropolitan Water Reclamation District, who is posing herself as a sort of a new competence turnaround candidate. So there's a lot at stake there, and I would encourage folks to read up more about it.
I'm glad you told us all about that. Any other races that you folks have your eye on, Simone?
You know, I think Amanda and Alex covered the specific races, but one thing I always encourage people to do is, because we do have judicial vacancies that are going to be on this ballot, and it's always worth looking those up, because, you know, you are more likely to encounter a judge in your day-to-day life than you are your congressperson, right? And so I always encourage folks to, Injustice Watch always puts out a great judicial guide where you can see where you are.
Shout out to Justice Watch.
Your judges.
Yeah. And, you know, I'll add too, there are some contested, again, so many, particularly within the city limits of Chicago, contests that are really decided in the primary. It's going to be a Democrat versus a Democrat, and whoever wins that, that's it. So the race is in March. And if you're in one of those areas, check it out. Shout out. WTTW has an extensive voter guide that was just published this week, well ahead of this early voting, so you can check it out.
So does WBEZ.org.
Yes.
I mean, there's
so many places to really watch and see those things. And some of these primaries won't necessarily get into the specifics right here and now, but we will be doing some of that. Check it out, because those are decisive.
Mm-hmm. You all recently covered on CityCast what people need to know about how to vote.
Yes.
Simone, any major takeaways or pieces of advice you want to offer?
I always have a few things I always remind people, because I feel like people forget. Number one, in the primary, right, you have to pull a party primary. Or if you feel some type of way about pulling a Democratic or Republican ballot, you can also pull a nonpartisan ballot if, for example, you wanted to just vote on Bring Chicago Home, right? That is a way that you can vote on that without having to pull the party ballot. Mail-in ballots, which is the way I vote by mail. I'm on the permanent vote by mail roster.
Okay.
Those are mailed out this week, and early voting is starting at the Supersite downtown, is starting next week, and then in all 50 wards, and then so on and so forth until we get to Election Day. But yeah, and the other thing I always say too is we have same day voter registration in Illinois. So, you know, it is never too late, truly. Yeah. At any point you might be thinking about voting and you want to register, there is a way for you to do it. I promise there is.
So you vote by mail. I'm curious how everyone else is going about it. WBEZ's Tony Arnold was on earlier this week to talk about WBEZ's voter guide, and he says he likes to go in the middle of the day on Election Day. Mm-hmm. Alex, you?
That used to be me. What I would do is, like, on my way into work, I would go on Election Day to my local precinct. It was always a breeze. Nowadays, the mail-in voting, it's just too easy. It's just too convenient. I can do it over the course of days if I want to. I can have all of my research in front of me.
Those voter guides right there at your fingertips.
WTTW one side, BEZ voter guide on the other side, switching back and forth. My advice to people always is, thankfully, like in Illinois and in Chicago, it's very easy to vote compared to a lot of places. But the one thing I would recommend people not do is early vote the day before the election. Because there are always lines, because there are fewer places, but everyone's like, oh, I want to early vote, but now is the time that I'm thinking about it. There are lines early voting the day before. Any other time you do it, it's going to be a breeze.
My other tip, too, is you can bring your phone into the voting booth. Mm-hmm. You do not have to, like, make all your decisions beforehand and feel like you have to memorize anything. You can bring paper. You can bring your phone. So it's not cheating. You can bring all that stuff in.
And I don't like to vote too early. I mean, Illinois has made it so incredibly accessible and given all of this time. To me, I want to know, particularly, again, when you have a tight contest, there's a lot that could come out. Journalists are still investigating and still on it. You're going to have potential news coming out. I know we'll talk about Trump later. I expect he'll be on the Illinois ballot. Who knows? We'll talk about that. There's some litigation going on. So what do I know? I'm not an attorney. But I mean, there's a lot that can still happen at this between this juncture and March 19th.
Well, Amanda, you guessed it. The time is now to talk about Trump, because at this point,
here we go.
He will be on the ballot in Illinois, and a Cook County judge denied a bid by Trump to stall an objection to his candidacy in Illinois until after the U.S. Supreme Court rules whether he's constitutionally eligible to seek re-election. So what's the significance of this, right? That now there's not going to be a delay. Right.
There's not going to be a delay, but it's also not expedited. So as we've been talking about, I mean, you can these ballots are getting mailed out. And so Trump's name will be on them, which is why you had the folks who are seeking to have him off say, we need the Illinois court system to hurry and take this. And the Illinois court system is like, nah. So we don't have any answers. They're not holding it up, I think, in part because the case behind this, there is there are additional questions outside of Trump that might be settled. And for example, the State Board of Election in ruling that the former president should be allowed to run again in Illinois said that the questions at hand here are such that they should be settled more on in the courts and on a federal level because they're constitutional and are outside of the scope of what the State Board of Election should be handling. Mm-hmm. That's a question that we might see resolved through what happens in Illinois, regardless of yesterday's arguments and what the U.S. Supreme Court takes of that.
Yeah. Speaking of yesterday's arguments, the U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments on Colorado's decision to keep Trump off the ballot in that state. Now, experts say that it appears the court will reject a challenge to Trump's eligibility, and that decision is expected soon. Alex, what do you make of that?
I mean, this really is the culmination of so many different challenges based on this specific reading of the 14th Amendment, which was written into the Constitution right after the Civil War, basically in order to prevent former Confederate leaders from running for office, saying that if you have engaged in an insurrection, you cannot hold office. And so a lot of challengers have looked at that and said, well, what was January 6th, if not an insurrection? And how, you know, obviously Donald Trump was a huge part in that, if not the main instigator. And, you know, there have been decisions going back and forth, Colorado and I think Maine also ruled to keep him off the ballot. But yeah, we heard the arguments in front of the Supreme Court, which I think is going to settle this once and for all, one way or another, for everywhere. And what it sounded like the Supreme Court is leaning toward is the same thing that the Illinois Board of Elections said and the same thing that Cook County Judge Tracy Porter said and so many other judges in the system, which is we are not touching this. We are not going to be the ones, regardless of the merits of the case, we are not going to be the ones to kick Trump off of the ballot.
Yeah.
And so in, it sounds like, I'm no, you know, Supreme Court expert, but it sounds like the only real suspense around the Supreme Court case is whether it is going to be an 8-1 decision or a unanimous decision to let him stay on the ballot. It is important to remember, though, that this is not the only legal challenge to Trump that is pending right now or even before the Supreme Court.
Not at all.
I'm watching the challenge over whether he, as a former president, is thus immune from all prosecution. That a court of appeals, federal appeals court, came out with this really, you know, scathing opinion, basically saying, no, of course, he's not immune from prosecution. Mm-hmm. And Trump is appealing to the Supreme Court. And a lot of folks, I mean, it's basically impossible to imagine that the Supreme Court would side with him on that. The only question is whether the Supreme Court will take it up, which would delay his other cases.
Well, this week, Nevada held both its Republican primary and its Republican caucuses. In the primary, Trump wasn't on the ballot, but former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley finished second to the none of these candidates option. Now, there was this interesting piece out from the Center for Illinois Politics on whether the Chicago suburbs is a place where Haley could actually win, in that you've got a more moderate Republican electorate there. Any thoughts on that?
You yourself just said that Nikki Haley lost by a resounding margin to none of these candidates.
None of these candidates.
2024.
Yeah.
I think that it's wishful thinking is putting it generously to think that she still has a chance. Like, oh, she lost everywhere else, including like New Hampshire, which is where all the independent voters are by wide margin.
But she's got a great shot in the Chicago
maybe
suburbs.
Rolling Meadows is where she's going to make her comeback. Maybe Schaumburg is where she, you know, starts her road to the presidency.
It will likely be, barring who knows what happens with court cases, in which case you could have an entirely changed dynamic. Again, why I don't like to vote too early. You don't know. But presumably the contest will be over by the time it gets to Illinois, so it's a non-question. I will point out Haley didn't campaign in the primary, and the whole question of primary versus caucus and having two times in New Hampshire, and there was a very, very low turnout. I mean, so the whole, or no, New Hampshire, I'm sorry, in Vegas, in Nevada. It's sort of a bizarre situation in general, but we have seen, I think, in the suburbs, they have gone more blue. And again, this is a primary, so you have to choose whether you're going to pull a Democratic or a Republican ballot in the first place.
Yeah. Let's talk state politics before we take a pause here, Amanda. Legislators got to work in Springfield this week on a number of issues. Among the biggest, they took up the tipped minimum wage. Briefly tell us what's going on there.
So we know that Chicago has decided to do away with this, which means that the servers who used to, say, primarily are bartenders that really relied on tips to get to the full minimum wage instead need to be paid that by their paycheck. And so there is an effort to take that statewide. I will add that this is not a new effort. This is something where folks have been campaigning in Illinois for Springfield to do that for, gosh, I think the first time I heard it was maybe 20 years ago that this was an ask to do away with the tip minimum wage. So it isn't new, but it has certainly been a resurged plan because of what happened in Chicago. What you're seeing, however, is a lot of pushback because those who live downstate say, we aren't Chicago. It is very different for communities that are, say, on the border or for areas that are in central and downstate Illinois where they're struggling. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. It is early in the session. We've had just a couple of weeks of meeting and very much legislators are in campaign mode eyeing both that primary and the general election.
And legislators are expected to weigh in on Chicago's elected school board. First of all, why would state lawmakers be talking about that?
It's up to them to make these sort of determinions. So it is also, they gave themselves really the assignment. They wanted to take it on and they gave themselves a deadline for figuring out what needs to happen with the Chicago School Board.
Do we have any sense of what they'll do?
We don't yet. The mayor has come out in the Sun-Times reported that Mayor Johnson is on the side of it. The big question is, how many seats will Chicago voters be deciding? And will that be the full 20-seat board or will it be half of that? And
For now.
Eventually, it'll get to the fully elected board. And so you have a standoff sort of where there are some, including the powerful president of the Senate, that had been on the half train and now wants for initially that first board to be wholly elected. And then you have the opposite where the Chicago Teachers Union and, of course, Johnson being part of that had previously wanted a wholly elected board. And now, lo and behold, he's in power, say that they only want half of the seats to be chosen by voters this time around.
Are you getting whiplash listening to this, Simone?
Because we've been covering this, and I think this is one of the most frustrating pieces of news that we've been following at CityCast for the past few years, because again, you have that whiplash, you have that flip, and it is, you know, right. As Johnson gets into power, he clears out the old school board, appoints a bunch of new people, has been getting a bunch of stuff done that he wanted to get done, right? And now we have this elected school board that is looming. This election is supposed to happen in November, and voters have no idea what they're going to be voting on yet or how it's supposed to work or where their district is. And you have candidates who have no idea
if they can even run.
If they can even run or where they're supposed to run or what they're running for.
Nice. And
it's just such a mess about how we're going to run, you know, the state's largest school district, one of the largest school districts in the country. I don't know. It just is really frustrating.
If you're teaching
to me,
about civics lessons,
yes,
and democracy,
yes,
it really is a poor showing.
We're all learning together.
Up next, Simone had the latest around the growing urgency around asylum seekers to the city. Governor J.B. Pritzker, Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle, and Mayor Brandon Johnson all met at City Hall earlier this week to discuss the issue. Here's Simone.
A lot has been made about Governor Pritzker and Mayor Johnson's relationship throughout this crisis and the influx of migrants that have come to Chicago. We got news this week that all three of these leaders are meeting. Johnson said afterwards, they're coming together, right? They're all working together. Mission's going to take all of us. We've all got to work together. what that will actually look like? That's a great question. Axios also reported this week that Chicago is going to be is working on trying to merge its homelessness services with migrant services, right? Trying to those agencies that do that work with both populations, trying to get more coordination on that front. So we are seeing some movement, but of course, we have some deadlines coming up after Mayor Johnson pushed back the deadline to evict migrants who are staying in city-run shelters. That's going to start coming up in March. And so, you know, you have folks who are looking for housing, struggling to find housing. You have a state program that can help with housing, but it's, you know, how much is that going to do? Are they going to build any more shelters? There's still a lot of questions that we just don't have answers to.
A lot of questions. And despite the nearly 35,000 migrants that have arrived here in the last year and a half or so, we should note the number of buses that have arrived recently has actually dropped dramatically. Now, you know, some days we didn't see any arrive at all, though the city does expect for that to change when it warms up outside and when we get closer to the DNC, which, of course, we're hosting. So I'm curious what you think, Amanda. Is the Texas governor biding his time until the DNC?
You know, I unfortunately have tried to reach out to Greg Abbott's office and have not received much communication back. I think I got one response in the various attempts to get reaction from the Texas governor's office. So I don't know, but that's certainly the speculation. It is very clearly political that there are migrants being sent to cities and to states that are controlled by Democrats that have sanctuary status. And Abbott has been very equivocal that that's intentional, saying that, oh, yeah, you believe that you want to welcome and be a welcoming city, be a welcoming state. This is what it means. These are the issues that we're facing along the border. So it is intentional. And I think that there is no question that we are going to see an attempt to really make this difficult for President Biden and for any Democrat.
If you're just tuning in, it's Reset. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. We're going behind the headlines in the weekly news recap with Amanda Vinicky of WTTW's Chicago Tonight, Simone Alisea of CityCast Chicago, and Alex Nitkin of the Better Government Association. Alex, let's move on to sports. The White Sox could be moving from their ballpark in Bridgeport to the South Loop.
Yeah. It could be. So I said
next story.
Like, okay. Yeah. It's sort of a sports story, but the reason why I love it is because it's really a real estate and public finance story. So
see what we did there?
Okay, so this past week, Related Midwest, which is the developer that owns this area bound by Roosevelt, Cermak, Clark Street, and the South Branch of the Chicago River. It is this barren stretch of undeveloped land very close to downtown. Well, it's not barren anymore because in 2019, Related Midwest bought it, rezoned it, and unveiled this big sparkling mega development proposal called the 78, called because it's going to be the 78th Chicago neighborhood, a whole new neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And this past week, we got some renderings, some really nice looking renderings.
Did you see them?
Oh, I saw them from the White Sox and Related Midwest showing what a new ballpark would look like in the middle of the 78. And I mean, it looks really cool. It's like a new, it's flashy. It's surrounded by all these, you know, apartments and bars and everything, and would have like thousands of new apartments, and including like 1,000 new affordable apartments. A pet peeve of mine about both Wrigley Field and Guaranteed Rate right now is that they're both like faced away from downtown, so you can't see downtown and the skyline from there. And so I have to admit, it was very satisfying to see these renderings of like you're sitting in the stands behind home plate and like Sears Tower, Willis Tower is like right there.
Well, I want you to, while we're on the topic, give us some top level takeaways here. Like, what looks from your view to be the pros and the cons of the team moving in a major ballpark in the South Loop?
Besides the skyline view.
Yeah. Well, obviously that's the most important. So I think that it's arguably like there aren't really any cons that you can think of to like the plan itself. It looks really nice. The aldermen have said like, yeah, if we can pull this off, it looks great. What they're pitching is just like, it's utopian. It's just like they're developing.
But the con would be
Bridgeport.
To the existing neighborhood, right? I mean,
it would be the existing neighborhood in Bridgeport. Well, what's interesting is that their proposal is to turn the existing Guaranteed Rate Field into a soccer stadium where the Chicago Fire would play. They would develop that. And so it's like everything is happy. everyone's happy in theory. The con is that, like, someone's got to pay for all of this, obviously.
Yeah.
And in, like, my hackles went up when I was reading about this, when the White Sox and Related were like, this is going to create $10 billion in economic benefit. And, like, it's going to be create so much money. Usually when organizations or teams especially are saying something like that, it's because they are about to say, please give us some public money so that we can make this happen.
Yeah.
And so that's what everyone's watching for.
Well, something else that you joked, actually, Alex, was the biggest story of the week, aside from the skyline. Barnes & Noble, it's planting a flag in Wicker Park. I'm curious if you were surprised that Barnes & Noble was still opening bookstores.
I was very surprised. I was very pleasantly surprised. I had been under the impression that Barnes & Noble was sort of dying out everywhere. I have been, you know, for years mourning the loss of the Webster and Clybourne Barnes & Noble.
Same. My daughter, too.
I just love to go and just, like, hang out there, pick some books off the shelf.
So many mother-daughter dates there.
Aww.
Yeah. That's really nice.
That was perfect. Our thing. And she would get a drink. Hot beverage. Would sit down.
Yeah, we don't know if there's going to be a cafe. Like, there's no real information,
but I will say.
But you've got to imagine that there would be, or that they'll do something cool with that old bank vault.
Yeah, they're
and
opening
there are local bookstores nearby, so you can do kind of a whole book route.
Well,
perhaps.
Here's the thing: you bring up a good point.
If it doesn't hurt them, yeah.
You bring up a good point because Barnes is opening 4 locations. But that one in Wicker Park, it's notable because it's like within earshot of quite a few independent bookstores. I don't see those shops as being happy about this big corporate bookstore coming on in
to
town.
I had that same thought when we were talking about this, because I saw this news and people seemed to be really excited and shared also, like, I also have, like, nostalgic Barnes & Noble memories as well. But I was like, there's so many great bookstores over there. Why are we, I don't know. Am I the only one who thinks it's weird to celebrate the coming of a major box bookstore?
I celebrate whenever a vacant space is filled
fair
with
enough.
Something fair because there's way too much
a
of it, unfortunately.
One at that.
Especially,
exactly.
I mean, we were all kind of dismayed when that Walgreens closed there with the big vitamin vault. And so now the question is, will it be the young adult vault? Will it be the
banned book
vault?
I saw a suggestion. I kind of like that.
We're just happy that books are making a comeback.
Yeah. Yes. I would also just like to point out that this is the exact plot of the book, of the movie You've Got Mail.
Oh,
such a good movie, except for I hope it doesn't end that way. So, like, shout out to Volumes Myopic.
Oh, yeah.
They are still wonderful. Get a book from each. Go read them at one of the many independent or chain coffee shops.
All right. So after thousands and thousands of submissions, Chicago's second annual snowplow naming contest is over. I want to read you the top 6 winners here. Control Salt Delete.
Ha ha. Yeah.
Casimir Plowoski, Skilling It, Ernie Snowbanks, Mies Vandersnow, and Bad Bad Leroy Plow. Which one gets your vote, Amanda?
They're all so good. I love it. I was impressed. I actually spent way too much time looking over all of the entries, and there are so many good ones. It was hard to choose. I mean, since evidently all of Chicago right now is celebrating Skilling upon his retirement.
Yes.
Gotta say, Skilling It is just fun to say. I'll go with Skilling It for today.
My favorite one was Control Salt Delete. The minute I saw it, that really just, like, made me chuckle, and I think it works. I think it works visually. I think it works auditorily.
The Chicago tie-in though?
Our senior producer Meha loves Ernie Snowbanks. So shout out to Ernie Snowbanks. That gets a vote.
I feel like there were so many on the, like, long finalist list that just got robbed. That
I
were
know.
So much better. There is
Chance the
Scraper.
We don't need to name more
City
things.
City of Big Shovels.
This is like the second
Kevin
recap
McPlowister.
Where I've tried to, you know, give it some love.
I like Kevin McPlowister.
The panelists just shoot it down.
Bicycle Jordan is a pretty good one.
There were so many good ones.
That's
why
so
do
good.
We have to stop? How many plows are there?
Snow or Whacker Drive.
Here's the thing about the snow, the naming the snow plow that our host Jacoby Cochran brought up is, like, are these also the same snow plows that they use to, like, block protesters? Like, do these snow plows have the same name? Like,
but now they're going to be blocked by the Unslushables, so it'll be cute and, like, fun.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, that's the idea. Before we go here, we got about 30 seconds. Quick, tell me what you're working on next week, Simone.
Next week, we have a Punchki taste test coming out. That is going to be really, really good. Or no, we did that this week. Oh, my God. We have a dumpling taste test coming out for Lunar New Year.
Nice.
I don't know what days are.
Okay, I want to be covering Punchki and dumplings. Can I please go and be part of what CityCast is? What am I doing? I'm going to be getting out, as I said, looking into some of these primary contests that would be of interest to Chicago.
Silly question. And Alex, real quick.
I'm going to be watching City Council Business. They're probably, hopefully, maybe finally going to be looking at the ordinance reining in dollar stores and where they can open. So that's going to be the big chatter.
All right. Well, that's it for the weekly news recap. My thanks to journalists Alex Nitkin, Amanda Vinicky, and Simone Alisea. Have a great weekend, folks.
Thanks.
Thanks, you too.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Dan Tucker, and Meha Ahmed edited the episode. It was mixed by Brenda Ruiz. If you enjoy our weekly news recap, subscribe to the Reset Pod so that you'll never miss the next one. From city and state politics to national and international news, we have you covered with the latest information, sharing all different kinds of perspectives and keeping you in the know and in the loop. Thanks for tuning in to this week's news recap. I'm your host, Sasha Ann Simons. Check out our podcast feed tomorrow for a special Saturday pod.
My name is Donald. I live on the southeast side of Chicago. I support WBEZ because of the balanced reporting and covering so much about an issue as opposed to just the few seconds that you may hear on most other news outlets. It matters to me to hear the story more completely.